What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, another letter to legislators from the C-suite on voting laws in America.
This is a very thorny line to toe for corporate America. So interesting to see who signed, who didn't, who's still speaking out. And is that going to be enough?
Just 2 weeks after black executives vocally opposed Georgia's voting law, a larger cohort is speaking up.
If the idea is that we're going to export a democracy, if the idea is that our democracy matters more than anything else and that that's what should be a shining beacon to the rest of the world, it's actually important that American companies speak up and say so.
Moderna's COVID vaccine more than 90% effective 6 months after the second shot. Vaccine pipeline and safety with CEO Stefan Bancel.
We looked at the data of 64.5 million doses that are being administered to people around the world, and we have not seen any data suggesting any association with blood clotting or thrombotic events.
Plus, crypto's day has come. Coinbase is set for its massive debut, and longtime Bitcoin bull Mike Novogratz says it's only the beginning.
This is a really important day for the whole crypto world, right? This is saying this is an asset class, and it's an asset class that's here to stay. Coinbase isn't a fintech company, right? It's a crypto ecosystem company.
It's Wednesday, April 14th, 2021. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning and welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin along with Joe Kernan and Melissa Lee. Becky's off today. New this morning, a powerful message. Hundreds of companies and executives from around the country signing on to a new statement opposing discriminatory legislation that would make it harder for people to vote. The new signatories include some of the largest companies in America, Amazon, BlackRock, Google, Warren Buffett signing that letter personally, General Motors. The list goes on and on and on. The new statement was organized in recent days by former American Express CEO Ken Chenault, who helped organize a letter opposing such legislation signed by dozens of black executives last month.
What we have heard from corporations is general statements about their support for voting rights and against voter suppression. But now we're asking, put those words into action. When it comes to protecting the rights of all Americans to vote, there can be no middle ground.
He came on our air with Ken Frazier, who also helped organize the statement.
We're actually making it much harder for people to actually cast their votes. And then on top of the fact that people are standing in line for ungodly hours, we now make it illegal to give those people water when they're standing in line. Because of course, we know from experience that only fraudulent voters get thirsty when they're standing in line. There is no substantiated, compelling evidence of voter fraud to justify these restrictions. Democracy depends on every voter in this country having free and fair access to vote without discrimination and without undue hindrance.
The statement, we should say, does not address specific legislation in states. But among the notable companies who declined to sign the statement, and this is where things get interesting, Coca-Cola and Delta, which had both spoken out against the Georgia voting law, but decided not to, in part because of the remarkable blowback that they received after this. Mitch McConnell has come out quite publicly against companies on this as well. J.P. Morgan was not a signer in this regard. Nike, not a signer. There's a number of companies that do business in China, for example, that were concerned about being described as, quote, hypocrites if they were to take this position here in the United States, but elsewhere. But I have to say, when you really look at this, this is not 72 black Americans, black business leaders who are coming out saying this as they did just 2 weeks ago. This is now some of the largest companies in America that are concerned about what's happening in now 47 different states that have a number of different proposals on the table relating to voting laws, ostensibly meant to protect the vote and make the vote more secure. But in many instances, I think it's impossible to suggest that in some cases they suppress the vote for one particular party. I should say that all of these things, all of these voting proposals have been put up by the Republican Party. I know that both of the Kens and I believe all of these companies would say this is a not a partisan issue. This is an issue about democracy mm-hmm. and about making sure we don't have a corrupt democracy and that the process unto itself is not corrupted. But it's fascinating to see so many companies decide to stand up and to speak out specifically on this issue. And their concern really about what they say, and I should say this, what they say is the big lie. And I don't want to make this political, but I think there's a real concern that a lot of these laws have been drawn up in part because of a view that has been espoused over and over again that the last election was somehow not secure. Mm-hmm. And that leaving that history or by creating new laws, it almost embeds that as the accurate history, which, of course, I think we know now it is not.
Right. It is interesting, though, in this culture now, corporate culture of having to take a stand on social issues to see which companies are willing to go ahead and sign that statement and which companies did step back. They spoke out against it. But, you know, you sell Coca-Colas to Democrats and Republicans. There can be blowback, as you mentioned, in terms of being viewed as a hypocrite, especially when China is pointing to the U.S. as being a hypocrite in and of itself in terms of human rights and civil rights violations. This is a very thorny line to toe for corporate America. So interesting to see who signed, who didn't, who's still speaking out. And is that going to be enough in this environment? So.
Well, and it'll be very interesting to see whether it changes the dynamic or whether, you know, you look at a state like Arizona, Michigan, other places where you're seeing some of these laws. I'm not sure. I don't know how much it changes the game or not.
Andrew, don't you think that this in particular was a pretty generic statement that mm-hmm. I think almost anyone would sign? That, yeah, anything that discriminates or suppresses vote, the vote you would not want to pass anything like that. But then you're going to get into the issue of whether asking for identification suppresses the vote. And de facto, right. It probably does, I guess, because there's a lot of, you know, in Georgia alone, there's 200,000 black Americans that do not, or black Georgians that don't have a driver's license. So would they get the state-owned ID or the state-issued ID? Probably, right. I don't know how many would. But, you know, it does raise a lot of questions, though, that not giving enough credit to people that they would get a state ID. I mean, I'm sure you right. if you could eventually do that. It is a weird point that we're at, Andrew, where people are talking about mandatory vaccines, but you can't ask for an ID to vote. I mean, it's hard to square.
I would just make one distinction here, which is I think that when, and I've spent a lot of time on the telephone with both Ken Chenault and Ken Frazier and many of the CEOs who signed this letter. I feel like since Saturday, I've been on the phone with so many of them trying to understand their particular view of this. Many of them believe that there are elements of these laws that are helpful. And I think the ID element of it unto itself is not something that in every case they're objecting to at all. Right. In the state of Texas, part of the issue, for example, is a college ID doesn't count. Right. And there are things, there are just issues around, as we've talked about, you know, how many absentee ballot locations are there? Right. When can you get access to them? Can working people actually get access to them if they close at 5 p.m.? Of course they can't, especially when they're in the inner city. If you go from having, you know, 40 of them to 8 in particular locations, by right. default, that's making it harder to vote.
But
and
how
it's
many
clearly
did you say there
vote
are there 47?
For political
each one,
purposes.
You would need to look at each one individually, and I don't think that's being done. Right. How many did you say there were, 47? And we just
well, no, I think in Georgia, for example, I think
no,
you know, you,
how
look,
many new voting, how
oh,
many different states are considering
oh, I think,
things?
You'd have right to look now, at it it's on something a case on the order of, yeah. 47 different states, and you have to go state
each
by state.
One.
But what I think you're
right.
going to do is see companies do that. And, you know, one very famous CEO who we've been on the show with a million times said to me, he said, look, the craziest part about this situation is if you had a manager inside your company who was running around saying that the CEO or whomever didn't deserve to have the job and got the job through, you know, through all the wrong reasons and was lying about it, you would fire that person. He said, instead, what we're doing is we're creating laws that effectively effectively enshrine that as truth. And I think that was actually fascinating, just because he put it in the sort of management context of a business and the way he runs, you know, he runs it. And also, I think there's a view that, you know, when we could talk about China, but if the idea is that we're going to export a democracy, if the idea is that our democracy matters more than anything else, and that that's what should be a shining beacon to the rest of the world, it's actually important that American companies speak up and say so and try to make sure that it is.
Right, but you also want to guarantee you also want to guarantee one person gets one vote, and that's why it works. Whether there's a narrative that there was, you know, it is the big lie and it didn't really happen, you still want to make sure that one person gets one vote. Because if there was any type of fraudulent voting, that disenfranchises the person
100%, except that there hasn't been evidence that there was, and in fact this last election
there wasn't evidence that there was a massive amount that would have changed the election. No one's saying it wasn't, that there's zero, and to try to just compare signatures is difficult. I mean, it's a sticky, thorny issue. Delta and Coke, initially they said, we've worked with the Georgia legislature and we've made this a better law. Then there was all the pushback and they said, okay, we condemn it completely. Right. Then there was pushback again that we're not going to, you know, buy it. And now they didn't sign this letter. So they're, you know, they're...
All right.
What did Michael Jordan say? Republicans buy sneakers too. I think he said that.
But I don't think that's what this is about. I think their case, there was the blowback. I think there was a view of, we put out our statement already. Why do we need to say it again?
I would sign this. That anything that is discriminatory in terms of voting, you would obviously, that it's so generic that anyone would sign it. But then you need to look at
the one thing I would just suggest to you is if these laws were what they say they are, I think we would all agree that what you could do is you could come up with ways to both secure the vote and actually expand voting. You could say we're going to have more drop boxes, but we're going to have security at those drop boxes. We're going to open them 24 hours a day. We're going to work with people to get them ID cards. If really ID cards were something people wanted, you would say we're going to spend millions of dollars to actually create campaigns to go out into the community. I mean, there are things you could do, but that is not what is happening in these instances.
A lot of people are talking, are discussing this, but not really out in the open a lot either, Andrew.
Next on Squawk Pod, Johnson & Johnson's vaccine may be paused, but Moderna's is still going strong, showing over 90% effective 6 months after its second dose. CEO Stéphane Bancel.
This is yet another proof to the American people that we have the best regulatory agency in the world.
That conversation right after this.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod from CNBC. In vaccine news today, Moderna said its vaccine is more than 90% effective at protecting against COVID and more than 95% effective against severe disease up to 6 months after the second dose. Yesterday, we told you about the federal pause on Johnson & Johnson's single-shot vaccine after six women who received it developed a rare blood clotting disorder.
With that, let me hand it over to Dr. Fauci.
This was out of an abundance of caution.
Safety is the important issue here. We are totally aware that this is a very rare event.
Johnson & Johnson's vaccine is built using traditional technology. An actual piece of virus is included. Just under 7 million Americans had received the shot from J&J. the White House says this pause is temporary and will not impact the goal of vaccinating the whole country quickly.
My message to the American people on the vaccine is, I told you all, I made sure we have 600 million doses. There's enough vaccine that is basically 100% unquestionable for every single solitary American.
The vast majority of vaccines administered in the U.S., over 100 million so far, have been from Pfizer and Moderna, which both use what's called messenger RNA. It trains the body's genetic material to recognize the novel coronavirus and fight against it. Moderna's updated efficacy data today comes from a phase 3 clinical trial, and it brings the biotech company, this COVID shot is their first ever vaccine after years of mRNA development, one step closer to filing a request for full U.S. approval beyond the current emergency use authorization. Once it gets full approval, it can start marketing the shots directly to consumers and selling them to individuals and private companies in the U.S. Moderna's CEO joined Squawk Box today with Joe, Andrew, Melissa Lee, and CNBC's Meg Terrell.
Meg Terrell joins us now with a very special guest. I guess, Meg, you know what? It's going to be, we're going to want to know every 6 months about lasting immunity and antibody response to these vaccines. We're just going to have to, because it's going to be our life from now on.
Right. This is a brand new virus. And so every 6 months gives us new information about how long these brand new vaccines will last. Stéphane Bancel, the CEO of Moderna, joins us now. He's got that information. Stéphane, let's start with, of course, the big news of this week, what Joe was just talking about, the J&J vaccine and the safety concerns around those six reports of these serious but rare blood clots. You've looked into your data. Your vaccine has been given to millions of people. Do you see any similar risk of blood clots or any kind of safety event with your vaccine as of now?
Good morning, Meg. Indeed, we are following very closely the safety as we should and are in constant dialogue with the CDC and the FDA. And indeed, we put a statement out yesterday that we looked at the data of 64.5 million doses that have been administered to people around the world. And we have not seen any data suggesting any association with blood clotting or thrombotic events.
What is your interpretation of sort of the FDA's move here? There was a lot of criticism yesterday that this would lead to vaccine hesitancy. A lot of messaging also that because we had not seen this with the mRNA vaccines, you know, people will be encouraged to get those as this gets worked out with the J&J vaccine. But are you concerned about hesitancy about vaccines as a result of this situation?
I actually believe quite the opposite. If you think about it, this is yet another proof to the American people that we have the best regulatory agency in the world. And they care deeply about the scientific and medical safety of a product. And they will take any signals like we saw last fall. If you remember, some companies had paused on their clinical trials because the FDA wanted to proceed safely. I think you see the same thing. So I think it will just show again to the American people that the FDA will not hesitate to be very cautious, to analyze the data, to take the time required to do so, to protect the safety of the American people.
Mm. This, of course, puts more pressure on Moderna and Pfizer here in the United States to deliver vaccine doses and perhaps around the world as well. You know, this might just last a few days for Johnson & Johnson, and then it might be back up and contributing to supply. But as of now, how does your manufacturing look? Are you confident you can hit all of your targets here in the U.S.? And are you looking at the same goals around the world? Is there any way of increasing output this year?
Yes. So, as you know, we had a goal of 100 million doses for the first quarter. We finished that a few days before the end of the quarter, which was an amazing effort by our teams and our partners. Just to put it in perspective, in 2019, we made less than 100,000 doses for a full year. So you can imagine the type of ramp up that the team had to do. And I confirm that we are on track to deliver the second tranche of 100 million doses to the U.S. government by the end of May, and on track for the third one by the end of July. And if you look at the data, which, you know, I happen to do every morning on the CDC website of vaccinations, it's really heartwarming to see that, you know, we have, you know, around 80% of adults above 65 years of age in the country that have already got one dose. And so I think we're getting to a point, as you know, most states will allow vaccination 16 and above as of next week. So I think we're already getting into a phase that I believe in the next 30 days-ish, I believe this country is going to go from a situation of not having enough vaccines to having potentially too many vaccines.
Stefan, when we look at the efficacy, we can't help but think both as individuals and as populations. So 90% is such a great number. But as an individual, you would think, wow, I've got a 1 in 10 chance still, even though I've gotten the Moderna vaccine, I've got a 1 in 10 chance of still getting COVID. That might be what you draw from that conclusion. But in reality, if you had 90% of the population vaccinated that had that type of efficiency, there is a number where the virus just sort of burns out. And I'm sure it's much lower than 90. I'm not asking you to be an epidemiologist, but what is that number for? Like, because 6 months from now, we may not be 90, we may be 80. 6 months from then, we may be 70, we may be 60. But can't you keep this virus under control even at 50%?
So I think it's a bit too early to know, Joe, exactly what is required, as Dr. Fauci and others have said. What I think this really shows is what we have been saying for now months, is that we believe we're all going to need boosting. And as you know, Moderna has been very active in its boosting strategy. We're testing three different strategies in parallel to make sure we pick the best one. We're testing in the clinic right now, boosting with a currently authorized vaccine. And we believe that's going to be helpful because you're basically going to boost all the neutralizing antibodies to people who have received vaccinations already.
We're also testing,
as you know, a new program called mRNA-1273.351, which is 100% copy of a full spike protein of the virus variant first identified in South Africa. And we're also testing a combo of those two, 50-50 mass ratio, product called 1273.211. And so we actually put out yesterday a preclinical paper showing that those boosting strategy with variant vaccines show very high neutralizing antibodies. And so we are pretty confident that as we get the data in the coming weeks in humans, we should see the same thing.
Which is part of the promise of this very agile technology, the messenger RNA technology. So you could boost just normal immunity to the original COVID and combine it with some sequences for some of the variants in the booster and do that fairly quickly and fairly easily.
Correct. And the regulators have given very clear guidelines. They do not need efficacy study, but neutralizing antibody in people that were vaccinated a year ago. We are doing this currently, so I think it's going to be a few months to getting that data ready to file to the regulators. Our goal is to work really hard to get this ready before the fall. I want to make sure there are boost vaccines available in the fall so that we protect people as we go into the next fall and next winter season in the U.S.
Stefan, a lot has happened in the past 24 hours, which has led investors to rethink how they value your stock. Yesterday's boost was a $4 billion add to market cap. It looks like another couple billion this morning. Can you walk investors through how you think about, first of all, the move closer to full approval, which would allow you to sell the vaccine directly to private companies, but then also the notion that Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca as vaccine makers, the competitive pressure is largely abated. And so, therefore, the pricing pressure on your vaccine and Pfizer's vaccine pretty much goes away or is eased. How should we think about these two items of news and how they impact your forecasts?
Yes, that's a great question. I mean, as you know, we are now, 15, 16 months chasing this virus. And if you look at how the different technologies have played out, the protein vaccines are not approved yet. The adenovirus vaccines have lower efficacy and potentially, this is again for the regulator to determine some rare safety issues and also potentially more manufacturing challenges. As you know, one of the great performance of mRNA is we do not need cells to make the product. It is made in water with enzymes. It's much more scalable. And if you look at the two mRNA companies that are on the market, they have been able to deliver, whereas if you look at companies across the globe, there have been more challenges with other technologies. So I think as this race against this virus continues and accelerates, because as Joe just said, the variants are going to be moving at a very fast pace. They're emerging everywhere. I personally worry deeply about the next 6 months as the Southern Hemisphere move into its fall and winter, we're going to see a lot of cases in the south. You already see spikes around the world. And you're going to see many more variants coming because many of those people are not vaccinated. And many of those people are immunocompromised. Like there's a lot, for example, of HIV positive patients in those countries. And I'm not surprised to see variants of concern in Brazil, in South Africa, and in India and other places. And so I think now it's all a race against this virus. You know, we've increased our manufacturing capacity. We've announced it a few weeks ago. And assuming the variant strategy hold at a 50 microgram dose or below, which is what we're testing in the clinic right now, we could have up to 2.8 billion doses for boosting in 2022. So I think that as the race against this virus continues and need to keep a very strong pace, I really think there's no technology better positioned in terms of efficacy, safety, manufacturing scalability, and speed than mRNA technology.
Stefan, I got a follow-up question to that. Should investors increase what they think about sales, given what you said about the next 6 months potentially, but also based on your timeline for now for full approval for the vaccine, as well as the idea that pricing pressure has largely gone away, one of the worries of the bear case for Moderna?
Yeah, I think the most important piece for me is the boost. Mm-hmm. I know some investors have not believed we're going to be selling boost next year and in 23 and in 24. This virus, as I've said before, and many epidemiologists have said, is not going away. It is not leaving the planet. We have to live with it. And we're going to live with it like we live with flu. We're going to get annual boosting. I anticipate that in the next year or so, we're going to see a lot of variants. But as more and more people get vaccinated or naturally infected, the pace of a variant is going to slow down and the virus is going to stabilize, like you see with flu. And so what we're trying to do at Moderna actually is to get a flu vaccine in the clinic this year and then combine our flu vaccine to our COVID vaccine so that you only have to get one boost at your local CVS store, at your GP every year, that will protect you to the variant of concern against COVID and the seasonal flu strain. And we believe we can get a high efficacy flu vaccine. As you know, the flu vaccines today, in good years, have 60% efficacy. In bad years, it's down to 30, 40%, which is, by the way, why many people don't take their flu shots. And we believe we should be able to get a high efficacy flu vaccines combined in the same shot with a COVID variant, high efficacy, so that you can take one dose and then have a nice winter.
Just one last question for you. You, of course, today are laying out your research and development in other vaccines using mRNA across diseases from RSV to CMV, HIV and flu, as you just mentioned. I wonder if you could just say, do you expect mRNA to work so well in all of these other viruses? You've set a pretty high bar in COVID in your first horse out of the barn here.
So we believe so, Meg. And I think there are three reasons. One is the fidelity of a biology. We're making a virus protein in a human cell. Not like protein vaccine in a bacteria cell, E. coli, or CHO cell. We're making this in a human cell in your own body. So it's totally mimicking a natural infection without giving you the virus, point number one. Number two on efficacy is we can make very complex protein. As you know, Meg, for CMV vaccine, we have six mRNA in the dose, and five of those have to come together and form a pentamer, form a very complex protein that is very, very hard, if not impossible, to do using recombinant. And it is made in your cells exactly like if you had a natural CMV infection. And the last piece is combination. We can combine things. And so if the right biology for this virus is 3, 4, 5 antigen, we can do that. We can follow the biology to ensure high efficacy. So do I believe most of those vaccines have a high chance to get high efficacy to the market? I do believe so.
All right, Stefan Bancel, it'll be quite the story to watch. We appreciate you being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, Bitcoin bulls everywhere are on the edge of their seats for the massive Coinbase debut. Crypto investor Mike Novogratz breaks it down.
Right now, total crypto wealth is roughly $2 trillion. So that's one half of 1% of all wealth.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate. Pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
You're listening to Squawk Pod. Here's Joe Kernan.
One of the biggest direct listings of all time, the cryptocurrency giant Coinbase, is going public today after getting a reference price of $250. Joining us now with more insight into the crypto world is Mike Novogratz, Galaxy Digital founder and CEO. So Bitcoin's almost $65,000. This is not the valuation that was bandied about, the $100 billion valuation, but still pretty good. Who's helping whom? Is the Coinbase listing juicing Bitcoin, or is Bitcoin juicing the Coinbase listing, or both?
Let's step back and let's not miss the big picture, right? This is like the Netscape moment for the cryptocurrency economy, right? Remember Netscape in 1995, 4 years before we had this crazy frenzy, basically signaled the beginning of the internet age. This is a really important day for the whole crypto world, right? This is saying this is an asset class, and it's an asset class that's here to stay. And so, listen, it's somewhat irrelevant where Coinbase trades today, right? There's okay. People that have been long at that. I'm sure at one point we want to take profits. But mostly institutions are going to come flooding into this space. And we're seeing it every day. We're seeing it in Bitcoin. And we're going to see it in the public equity markets. Coinbase is the first big marquee equity that mutual funds are going to be able to say, hey, I can make my statement in crypto this way. And so I just think you don't want to miss, by looking at the small technicals of what happens today, kind of the magnitude of the moment.
I'm willing, 2.5% to buy a Bitcoin with a huge spread versus setting up my own whole deal and figuring it out. It's worth it, but that's not going to stay like that. There's just no way. It's going to be driven down to like everything at some point. Wouldn't you think? And so what's the growth look like?
The amount of talent coming into this space, the amount of competition coming into this space is going to drive prices, right? But don't forget the amount of innovation. Like Coinbase isn't a fintech company, right? It's a crypto ecosystem company. And none of us really understand how big the TAM of that ecosystem is, right? All of a sudden, out of nowhere comes NFTs, which is going to be a huge part of the crypto economy. And so I think right now, total crypto wealth is roughly $2 trillion. So that's 0.5% of all wealth. If you don't think in the next 2 to 3 years that can be 2 to 3%, you're not paying attention to the trends. And so the amount of growth that we're going to see in our space is staggering. We're just getting started. And what's important is institutions now realize this is an asset class. It wasn't an asset class 8 months ago. I was hoping it would be. I was praying it would be. I was trying to convince people it would be, but now it's an asset class. And every single participant we talk to is getting involved.
Mike, you made a reference to Netscape when comparing Coinbase to this moment, but it struck me because one of the things that's fascinating about Netscape was it did create a moment and was hugely important in that moment, but of course, quickly disappeared from the scene. We don't talk about Netscape anymore. It got swallowed up with AOL and everything else. So when you think about Coinbase, do you believe we're going to be talking about Coinbase a decade from now, 2 decades from now?
A lot of that depends on how good Brian Armstrong continues to, how good he is, the talent he attracts, how quick he innovates. There are some amazing entrepreneurs in this space. Sam Bankman-Fried, at FTX, is doing things every day, right? Do Kim in Korea. And so, listen, there's competition like in every space. People see this is going to be a really interesting place to make a career and build businesses. And so, listen, Brian's done a pretty damn good job so far. And so I think a lot of people are going to bet on him. But, like, time will tell. He's got a there's an interesting story. When it was $6 billion, I remember going up to Tiger and I spoke to Lee Fitzell, who's one of the great private investors ever. And I thought he was overpaying at $6 billion. He said, Novogratz, you don't understand this. They have the brand. And so right. I'm buying the brand. And listen, Lee Fixell is probably celebrating today with a bottle of champagne. He should be. It was a great call on his part. And Tiger's investors, Mike, I'm sure, are happy. So
right now we are in we're in a crypto summer right now in terms of where the cycle is, clearly. I have to think. Maybe I'm wrong about that, too. But what happens if we do have a crypto winter again? And do you think that's almost impossible to think about?
Well, listen, there's a lot of froth and frenzy right now. You see some of these coins that don't even seem like Dogecoin last night went up 100%, right? So retail is in a frenzy. We are going to see volatility soon. Prices will not go straight up every day. They will go up and then they will go down. But there is a constant lineup of real players moving into this space that gives us a support floor. Goldman Sachs is moving into this space. Tech companies are moving into the space. And so while I think we can have volatility in prices, we're not going to have volatility in the amount of people that are joining this new economy, right? We've just determined this as an asset class. You are building out infrastructure. I've talked to six different central bank governors in the last few months, everyone working on their own central bank issued digital currency. And so just to build that infrastructure is a huge lift. And so this is not all about Bitcoin, though Bitcoin's a big part of it. It's about building a new financial markets infrastructure on blockchain. It's about building a new infrastructure for us to buy and sell IP, art, collectibles on blockchain. That's what this whole revolution is all about.
We got to go right now. Thanks, Mike.
That's Squawk Pod for today. On our rundown tomorrow, are you ready? The next chapter in this crypto revolution. The first big cryptocurrency business goes public in the U.S.
Hopefully Coinbase going public and having its direct listing is going to be viewed as kind of a landmark moment for the crypto space where, hey, this technology is here to stay.
Brian Armstrong, the CEO of the company at the center of the new crypto economy, in a rare interview. Don't miss Coinbase on the podcast. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Thanks to Melissa Lee for sitting in. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern. And to get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.